group will return. Will return probably in another half hour. I thought that today I'd try to integrate these four questions, I believe, that were put at the end of yesterday's discussion, try to integrate them into a kind of summary statement of some of the problems we've been dealing with this last week. And I hope that will afford an opportunity for those of you who are interested to push the discussion further. I'm not going to summarize what we have done in the same way that it was originally presented, but rather through a series of propositions which it seems to me have come out in the discussion and around which we can build the summary. The first, of course, the first proposition is that religion and politics are permanent factors, I would put it this way, but with changing expressions. Let me comment upon that as a proposition that's run through this last week's discussion. Permanent factors in the sense that they are inseparably connected with what we call humanity. In other words, as long as there is a humanity, there is a religion of some sort and a politics of some kind. There's no more chance of abolishing religion and politics than there is, for example, of abolishing the human body as long as human beings exist, because by definition, human beings are religious animals and political animals, to paraphrase Aristotle. That is to say, their fulfillment in the community means politics. Politics is not only a way of ordering, but is also a way of fulfilling the human impetus to sociality and to order and rationality. So these characteristics are built into our very definition of a human being. Similarly with religion, religion is also characteristic of the human animal. The need, in other words, to find an ultimate concern around which to build a life, a human life. That ultimate concern may be only dimly perceived. It may change during the course of an individual's life. But the quest is always there in one way or another, although we will be in greater or lesser degree conscious of it. Sometimes the level is the quest is at a low level of consciousness, at other times it will be at a very high level. I suppose in a sense you could say that the saint represents the one who has the greatest consciousness, the broadest and the deepest consciousness, almost by definition, of what we mean by a religious person. And most of us are down here someplace grappling with this question, sometimes not even being fully aware of what we're doing. But nevertheless, this is the proposition that I would suggest for you in thinking about the first statement, in other words, by way of summary. That is to say that religion and politics are permanent factors in the human situation. But their expressions are legion, consist of a wide variety of ways of reflecting the religious impulse and the political tendency in human beings. Now there's another general proposition that it seems to me emerged from this last week, that religious faith is built around one's ultimate concern, which could be a number of different things, but at any rate, ultimate concern or ultimates characterize religion. I like to think of it in a somewhat different way by saying that a religious faith is the premise of premises. That is to say, it's the ultimate of ultimates. What is the point at which, for example, one thinks of as the ultimate center around which one builds one's life? And that would be one's religion. The problem, of course, is that we tend as human beings to become impatient. We tend to wish to absolutize levels of consciousness before we reach, presumably, the ultimate of ultimates, whatever that may be. Or where we tend, in other words, to idolize limited things, technological development, for example, or political organization. And so there is a constant struggle among human beings or within human beings who have a religious consciousness to avoid absolutizing temporary, and limited things, making absolutes of them. That doesn't answer the question of what is the absolute, but at least we're looking for it, and there's a constant temptation to stop the quest, it seems to me, and to say, this is it, and immediately then to absolutize the sun or the moon or the trees or nature or our war machines and so on, and to make them matters of ultimate concern. And this was the problem that the Hebrew prophets were constantly calling attention to in their discussion of religion, it seems to me, the tendency to idolatry. And thus, there is a kind of dichotomy, it seems to me, or you can suggest a kind of dichotomy between what we might call prophetic religion and idolatrous religion. The prophetic religion always keeping open the exact character of the ultimate concern, but nevertheless questing for it, seeing it partly, but never as a whole. Seeing it, as St. Paul puts it, as through a glass darkly, not yet seeing it face to face, or only on very rare occasions would one presumably do that. Whereas the idolatrous religionist says, this is it, this particular invention of man or this particular object of nature. So I think the notion of ultimate concern or the notion of ultimates lies at the root then of our religious faiths and our religious institutions. Now, politics, as we said this last week, may be identified as that sphere of the human situation or human community in which, by contrast with pre-political orderings or pre-political ways of doing things, we seek consciously and potentially rationally to order and direct collective human affairs. This assumes, in other words, that there would be small communities that would have a political aspect and large communities. Potentially, the world as a whole, presumably, could be some kind of political community directed and ordered consciously as over against by tradition or by instinct. And out of this political dimension, of course, will emerge all kinds of problems as they emerge out of the religious side of our discussion. Problems, for example, of organization, problems of authority. How do you vindicate authority in the political sphere, for example? Is the basis of authority the majority will of the community, or is it something else? These are the kinds of questions that we pose on the political side. Another way of putting it, as I think I suggested this last week, is to say that religion seeks a whole vision, a vision as a whole, or an integrated vision as a whole, for human life in general, and for a whole vision on the perspective, or a whole perspective on the world. Political activity seeks a kind of integration in the community, consciously and deliberately, as over against, again, preconscious or traditional or merely instinctual artery. The political quest is a relatively recent quest, it seems to me. It may have been potential in human beings, but in actuality, it is reflected to any great degree only for the last 4 or 6,000 years at the most. It may have been there in the bud, so to speak, but it is relatively recent by comparison with the total biological life of the human species. As I recall now, some of the digs in Africa are supposed to suggest that the human race biologically, although that raises the interesting question of what you mean by human, goes back 3 million years. But it certainly does not go back 3 million years in terms of any great measure of recognition of the political. Most of that 3 million years was spent at a level that we would regard as only political potentially, perhaps. Where custom and tradition and instinct and so on, many of the things that govern animal life or beastly life are ruling. And the political element is slight indeed. One reason we tend to become discouraged, it seems to me, about the political realm is because we fail to recognize how recent it is. When you compare it with the biological human being. It's only a fraction of a minute compared with an hour, at least, if you take the whole span of biological existence of the human species. I thought I'd better enter an element of hope here very early. When you consider, say, 6,000 years by comparison with 3 million years, you get some impression, it seems to me, of the relative recency of a recognition of the political dimension. And we illustrated that, you'll remember, by such dramas as Sophocles' Antigone. Well, so we've suggested then thus far that the political and the religious are permanent elements in human existence, although their expressions vary widely. That the religious realm may be identified as that in which we are seeking to integrate or to focus around an ultimate concern of some sort. And that we're often frustrated in that request, in that quest, because we tend to wish to absolutize our own creations and thus to become stupid, according at least to the prophets. While not keeping the matter open. And thirdly, I've tried to suggest then that the political area is an area of conscious or potentially rational attempts to order and to control the collective, as over against, for example, allowing the collective realm to be ordered by accident, by a fortuitous concatenation of social forces, or by tradition or instinct. Well, so much now for the re-identification of the two areas. I'd like now to turn to how they intersect, how they relate to each other, and how they relate to the human situation, I suppose you could say. In other words, the intersection or the interrelationship of the political and the religious. And here I also have a number of propositions that I'd like to discuss. The first one is that a religious faith underpins every political faith. A political faith has to do with a particular aspect of human existence, ordering the collective realm, the realm of collective experience. A religious faith is broader and covers more ground, although it too is seeking a kind of holistic position. It's at this point, I think, that we ought to view with sympathy some of the so-called moral majority type sects and cults that have grown up around us, because it seems to me one of the things that they are trying to say, inadequately no doubt, is that you can't really separate religion from politics. There are a lot of cliches, I think, among liberals, which seem to suggest that not only can you separate church and state, but you can separate religion from politics. Nonsense. You can't. This is the proposition that I'm trying to suggest now, then, that implicitly or explicitly behind every political position in life lies some sort of an implicit, at least, if not explicit, religious faith. A political faith will flow from a religious faith. I hope that's sufficiently controversial so that during the discussion some of you will challenge it. But I'd like to emphasize it very strongly. We might at this point take a look, for example, at some of the so-called right-wing organizations and the way in which they seek to integrate religious and political faiths, since one of the requests you made yesterday was to do that, to look at the so-called cults more completely. And so I brought a list of current cults that we might use as the basis for our discussion then. There are the Moonies, of course, the Religious Round Table, the Moral Majority, the Christian Voice, the Liberty Lobby, the Christian Patriots Defense League, the Christian Conservative Churches of America, which were founded in 1959, and many, many others. I brought this list along with me just in case of need, and sure enough, I needed it. Let me comment upon these various groupings. They are by no means agreed on the implications for politics of their religious faiths. They, as a matter of fact, they differ very, very sharply. Let me
back up and find what you mean by a cult.
Yes, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. I'm using it because it's a common currency, and I don't like it myself, but since it's used, I'm using it here. Let me show, for example, how you can compare, or how different these so-called right-wing organizations are on particular issues of politics. Take, for example, something like the Liberty Lobby as over against the moral majority of Jerry Falwell. The Liberty Lobby is a kind of amalgam of very curious positions. It's often been called anti-Semitic, but I think that is a misstatement of its position. It's anti-Zionist, and one has to make a distinction between anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist if you're going to think clearly, it seems to me, about these matters. It's anti-Zionist, and it sees behind almost every activity, political activity of a major character in the United States, the ugly hand of Zionism, you see. But in many of its statements, it praises Jewish leaders who are anti-Zionist, for example. It makes that careful distinction, which some of us who are its critics, and I'm a critic of the Liberty Lobby on many grounds, do not make. Now, I think it's very important in looking at the so-called right-wing organizations to keep in mind the distinction among them. They can't all be put into the same mold, which is one reason I don't think they're going to last in any coherent sense. I think they're going to break apart. As a matter of fact, there are already tensions in that respect. On the other hand, if you, for example, compare the Liberty Lobby with the Moral Majority, which was founded in 1979 by Jerry Falwell, you'll find that the Moral Majority is very close to the State of Israel because it sees the State of Israel as the kind of harbinger of the end of time. You see, one interpretation, for example, of the history of the Jews is that when the Jews, this is from a so-called Christian point of view, when the Jews are finally gathered together once more in Israel, this will herald the second coming of Christ. Well, Moral Majority takes that position, that the State of Israel symbolizes the imminence of the second coming of Christ. Anything you can do to encourage the State of Israel, for example, will hasten the day for the second coming of Christ. Well, that's quite different, obviously, from the Liberty Lobby, with whom we often lump the Moral Majority. And it reflects, again, what I'm trying to suggest, the diversity of views on the so-called religious right. I don't even like that term religious right because I'm not sure what right wing and left wing means in this context. Well, you could go down the list of organizations I've given and notice the considerable difference. There is an apocalyptic note in many of them. Every generation has its apocalyptic sects, those who believe that there is imminent an end of history, a vast transformation of the world, a destruction of the old order and a rise of a new order. You see that, for example, in two of the organizations that I've listed here as members of the so-called religious right, the Christian Patriots Defense League and the Christian Conservative Churches of America, associated with a man by the name of John Harrell. The Christian Patriots Defense League is a body of people who believe that the world is very close to destruction. They don't know quite how it's going to happen. It may be through foreign invasion from the communists. It may be through corruption internally. But however it happens, it's very close. And a few people can be saved, only a few, and that's always characteristic of sort of apocalyptic sects. So they're getting ready to save themselves when everyone else will be killed. They're gathering rifles, for example, storing rifles. They're developing reserve food supplies. It'll be mouse-proof and so on. The element of destruction and so on. Taking it very, very literally, very much as sects have done throughout history. It's amazing how you recapitulate religious history every generation, it seems to me. Now, groups like that will tend to be anti-Semitic. That is, there are some of these groups that are anti-Semitic as over against anti-Zionist, but I do think it's important to keep in mind the distinction between the two. Now, I'm mentioning these so-called right-wing sects simply to illustrate what I've been saying, that it seems to me that at the root of every political belief system lies a religious commitment of some kind, as we define religion. And in that sense, the cults or the sects are simply carrying out the proposition that I've suggested here, and dramatizing it, illustrating it, and so on. Let me also add a note of caution, I suppose, for those of us who consider ourselves liberals. I think it's very, very easy for those of us who consider ourselves liberals to become condescending about religious sects, to believe that we have the whole truth. I find myself having to catch myself up always about these things, and not perhaps being open enough to the possibility that even a sect like the Liberty Lobby or the Moral Majority may be saying something to us that needs to be said, which then leads me to go back to this question as to what this term cult may mean conceivably. We try to make a distinction between today, between religions and cults. I think those who make the distinction don't have anything clear in mind, really. But as I understand the term cult, it refers to a small religious grouping of some kind with which we disagree. If you don't agree with a group, then you call it a cult, if it's small particularly. If you agree with it, it's something else. You very rarely will call it a cult. It's a matter of terminology here, it seems to me, very much, but there's a religious commitment running through most of these so-called cults. A religion can be false, in my view, and still be a religion, in other words. Much depends, again, on how you define that difficult word. So that there is, then, it seems to me, at the root of every political faith, some kind of a religious faith. I might quote Gandhi at this point again, I quoted him earlier this week, I believe. Those who say that there is no connection between religion and politics, Gandhi says, don't know what they're talking about. Well, that's what I'm suggesting here now, too, that there is always a link, you see, implicit or explicit, between the two realms. Now, a second proposition that I'd like to discuss briefly is that there are political implications in every religious organization. Now, we've dealt with that considerably yesterday when we dealt with the sociology of religion. When you embody religious faith in organization, then you get some of the problems that we always associate with the political. The question of how you organize, the question of optimum organization, what is the organization which will be most effective and at the same time least subject to corruption. There's a close link, in other words, between the problems that we confront in non-religious politics and the problems we confront in the politics of religious organization. This is another way in which the two realms, it seems to me, are connected. Another question that we've been dealing with this week has been the issue of how should we relate, or how should religious institutions be related to political institutions? Institutions that are primarily concerned about the general ordering of the community as over against the ordering of religious organizations. And that raised the question of the whole issue of church and state. What is an ideal relationship, if there is one, between church and state? Here it seems to me we can suggest broadly, and I'd be willing to defend this proposition, that there is no formula about how church and state should be related legally in the legal system. There's no formula that will not create problems of interpretation, of ambiguity, and so on. In other words, no matter what your formula about the relationship of church and state, there will always be ambiguities, inconsistencies, gray areas where lines seem to have to be drawn almost arbitrarily. And I think that came out in our discussion of some aspects of what it means to establish a religion, using the quotation from the First Amendment to the Constitution. My own position on this point is that the American arrangement is the best arrangement, probably, relatively speaking, so to speak, as it were, that we can discover in history. But it has all sorts of problems connected with it, as I tried to point out. As long as you recognize those problems and recognize that it is no magical solution, then it seems to me the American answer is as good a one as you can find. But as you look at the history of this problem, every formula will have its own peculiar problems, which I hope perhaps we might want to get back to during the discussion. Now, a fourth issue that ran through part of our discussion was, what claims can the religious conscience make? The whole issue of what we mean by religious conscience. We tried to define what we meant by conscience in general, pointing out its individualistic aspects, the in-wit side, and also its communal aspects, the joint knowledge side. Perhaps we didn't push far enough what some of the implications of the idea of conscience are for religion in general and non-religious consciences on the other side. The word conscience is closely connected, of course, with the word consciousness. I don't know if you've thought much about that or not, the connecting links between the two. If you think of consciousness as awareness, as I think one may do, awareness in varying degrees, as you find it, extreme awareness and sensitivity over here on the one side, and over here, low level or narrow awareness over here on the other side, you get, it seems to me, to some degree, a picture of the progress that conscience, presumably, ought to make to fulfill itself. Over here on this side, conscience is still tied to unreflective custom, let's say, or convention. Over here at the other extreme, which very few of us ever attain, the conscience we develop about anything as a result of our reasoning and intuitive processes. And conscience is the fruit of both, as I think I pointed out before. I don't think reason itself is enough to account for conscience. There's a realm beyond reason. The premises with which we begin, for example, in the moral quest, that must also be considered. Over here on this side, then, of the question of conscience is one that is a utopian kind of conception of conscience in which there is a very wide awareness and a deep awareness of all the implications of the action that I'm going to pass moral judgment on. And it seems to me that progress in the development of conscience means movement from this pole over here, this interpretation of the idea of conscience, over to this pole. As we do that, then, we get beyond unconscious elements in conscience, if you wish to point that out. In other words, elements that push us. And when you go over to this area, we get to the level of directing our own moral development, so to speak. The morally autonomous conscience, which in the process of development has taken into consideration the view of the group, or the views of the group, tested its own moral insight against those of the group, but in the end accepts the responsibility of passing judgment itself on a particular moral act. But that's what I mean by the notion of a morally autonomous conscience with a very wide consciousness and deep consciousness of the implications of the acts. That's an aspiration which most of us never attain. Well, let me say a word then about the relationship between religious conscience and other expressions of conscience. I think we suggested during the discussion that the religious conscience is a kind of integrating conscience, I suppose you could say. It's the ultimate statement of a moral position, a position about right and wrong, in connection with a specific case. Of course, it can be reflected in a great many different ways. We've argued today that behind every political faith must lie, for example, a religious faith, so that a political conscience would depend on, presumably, our arriving at as deep and as wide a consciousness of the political problem as we can, and relating that awareness to our ultimate concern. See, when this is done consciously, then you relate the political conscience or the economic conscience, whatever it might happen to be, about whatever issue, back to the fundamental integrating awareness or consciousness that we associate with the word religion. At least that's the way I would see it. And it may, I know it, every time I make a statement, I'm aware of ambiguities, so I better stop at this point and leave the ambiguities as they stand. Otherwise, I'll multiply them on this question of conscience. But at any rate, it seems to me that's been an important theme that's run through our discussion this week. Now, the last theme on which I'd like to comment is, what is the optimal type of organization for the achievement of religious and political objectives? The optimal type. Is what is the type of organization that, on the one hand, can help embody our religious and political awareness in the everyday concerns of life, can help embody that while at the same time avoiding the corruptions that embodiment always tend to involve? We dealt with some of those problems of corruption in any organization. One or two of you after the meeting suggested that I didn't give enough attention to the positive value of organization, and so I'd like to do that at the present point. I seem to be too critical, and I think I probably was, because I wanted to stress the other side. Organization is indispensable in human life. If you regard the human being as a social and political being for whom society is natural, then organizing that expression of sociality, of communal feeling, becomes a very vital aspect of human existence. If we assume that human beings were governed by instinct or by tradition merely, then the problem of organization wouldn't be important, because it wouldn't arise in our consciousness. But because it does arise, then we have to grapple with it. Organization is a way of implementing collectively the goals of a particular religion or a particular political position or economic position. In the political realm, in general, for example, the key problem, it seems to me, of organization is that of the economy, that is, scarce goods. What do you do about scarce goods? Because that's really what an economic good is. It's a scarce good. It's a limited good. If it was an uneconomic good, it would be limitless in availability, so to speak. I once had a student write an original utopian work, for example, in which he imagined a world in which the distinction between scarce goods and unscarce goods was abolished. Because when you wanted any new material thing, all you had to do was press a button, and the button always worked. And you could bring into existence whole universes. Well, in that situation, there would be no necessity, he argued, for allocation of resources, because the resources are infinite, would be infinite. They would, in effect, become like spiritual resources are today. In other words, today we can say an appreciation of the aesthetic qualities of painting, an understanding of love, an appreciation of a musical rendition, and so on. You can list a whole series of other things. These are in the realm of unscarce resources, that is, the appreciation, our capacity to appreciate. The fact that I appreciate these things in the spiritual realm does not mean you can't appreciate them and value them too, and have them. In other words, because they don't belong to the realm of scarce resources. And so we say then traditionally that religion has to do with the realm of unscarce resources, of spirituals, I suppose you could say, and an understanding of the spiritual realm. That's what I understand this term spiritual to mean. But when you embody the spirit, of course, in an organization and in politics, come across this problem of scarce resources, then in one way or another the resources are going to have to be allocated. You either allocate them directly through a rationing system, or you allocate them through a pricing system. So you always have to allocate them. And you always have to have a system of values in accordance with which you believe they should be allocated. And you always are depriving someone of some material goods in the process of allocation. You can't avoid it. At least I don't see how you can avoid it. You just have to recognize it. So that in the planning, in the general community, as over against the religious community, the central or key problem, it seems to me, is the economic problem, as we call it. How we should allocate those resources, according to what principles, who is to be denied those scarce resources, and who is to gain those scarce resources. And these questions cannot die as long as we are human beings, anyway, unless you imagine this abolition of the distinction between spirituals and temporals. When we get to heaven, of course, that problem will be raised, I presume. And there's no problem of conscious ordering in heaven, because the arrangement of angels and archangels is a given. You don't have this issue, seems to me. Now, but the two realms are connected in connection with this whole problem of scarce resources, obviously, because our religious views will have a lot to say, presumably, about justice. I hope they will. Social justice. And how do you apply those religious views to this difficult question of allocating scarce resources? I sometimes get a little bit amused when people say, should we ration or shouldn't we ration? There's nothing else you can do. You're always rationing. This depends on the method that you're going to use. When you ration by price, you depend upon the income distribution to do the rationing. In other words, the rationing by price means, on the whole, that lower income groups have a harder job often than if you ration directly and, let's say, allowed an equal amount of goods for every given individual. Because income distribution in most countries is such that what is supplied will be dictated by the upper income groups disproportionately. One reason, for example, we have a housing shortage in the United States and in many other countries is the income distribution system. A few, the upper 15 or 20%, tend to get a large proportion of the income and can, of course, bid for other things once they're safely housed, which deprives the lower income groups of their right to bid because their income is lower. So the problem of income distribution in connection with justice, and the prophets were always talking about justice as the test of religion. Don't talk to me about esoteric aspects of religion, the prophets were always saying. What do you do about justice? What do you do about the widow and the orphan? How do you assure that a retired person isn't deprived of his social security and so on? These are the issues of distributed justice, which become the test then, according at least to prophetic religion, of one's religious commitment. So there's a whole series of areas then in here in which you get an interweaving, it seems to me, of the problem of religious commitment and political or distributed justice that will not go away. And this doesn't mean that the problem of defining what you mean by distributed justice is an easy problem, but it may be a problem we want to get into from a religious perspective during our discussion. If you take, for example, the distribution of income in the world as a whole, you'll find a range, an enormous range. So the good many parts of the world will have an average per capita income.